What's up, Packers and NFL draft fans, and welcome back to another special draft edition of the Packer Report podcast, brought to you by Stadium View Bar, Grill, and Banquet Hall in beautiful Green Bay, Wisconsin. We've got another phenomenal draft expert, another phenomenal guest here in NBC, Roto World, Thor Nystrom. Thor, did I miss any affiliations, anything that you've got going on?
I don't think so, except that I'm a Vikings fan. I hope you guys forgive me for that.
Yeah, we have also, we don't let Arif come on the show, but we let all, you know, people from everywhere. In fact, you're our second Vikings fan, because we did have Jordan Reed from Draft Network come on and talk a little bit and had a great time, you know, breaking stuff down with him. So, yeah, for I don't know what it is. It must be these cold winters, and you guys just spent your youths just grinding film. And you know, when you couldn't go outside, I don't know how – I don't know how the upper Midwest keeps breeding these, you know, phenomenal draft minds, but you know, that's where we are. That's where we are. So Thor, if you want to take a little bit of time and just kind of share your credentials with everybody, let everyone know who you are, where you come from, how you got to where you are, where you're working now. And obviously the big deal that dropped today.
Yeah. So today I dropped the, called the Thor 500. It's my 500 player big board that y'all should go and check out on Roto World. And you know, usually I would say print that out and bring it to your draft party, but maybe this year bring it to your Zoom party.
This would be a binder,
you know, or you know, whatever you guys are doing. But it's
your exactly Zoom party.
You know, it's a like I said, 500 player big board, 500 comps on that thing. We've got spark scores, we got RAS scores, adjusted spark scores, and that's it. You know, nothing expository outside of that, just 500 names, you know. And it's something where, you know, talking about my past, like I'm one of those guys, and probably, you know, like if you listen to this podcast, this might describe you as well. I've been obsessed with the draft since I was a kid. I've been obsessed with college football and the draft. Like those have been my two jams. I was the kid who watched all seven rounds. Like even when I was at birthday parties, I'd be the kid who was like sneaking away like to the extra TV, like upstairs, like trying to find like, where's a TV I can find, you know, turn the thing on or whatever, you know? And then like when the thing was done, I go up to, you know, at my house, like print off the seven rounds, you know, and like look through and everything like that. And as far as the 500 board, one of my criticisms or one of my things was always like, once the draft got over, there was no list. This is when I was a kid. There was no list that went deep enough where when the Vikings, you know, my team, when they started to sign guys, that I could reference to say, like, is this guy any good or is that guy any good? Because usually I just didn't know, like, you know, is this dude, is he interesting or whatever? So I'd have to wait till the next day or the day after and see in the Star Tribune if the writer said anything about him. Sometimes they didn't. And so I, you know, now that I have the time that I do this full time, and I actually have time, you know, over the previous several months and really over the previous several years, because I cover, like I said, college football full time until we get to mid-January after the national championship game. And then it turns into NFL draft coverage where I can do this, study all these guys, you know, in depth, where I wanted to rank out 500 guys. So once we get past Saturday night and then we get into the UDFA free-for-all, where fans can look, can reference this list and say, oh, my team signed this guy, my team signed that guy. Like maybe this guy should have gone in the seventh round, or maybe this guy should have gone in the sixth round. And we were just able to get a free flyer on him if he fell through the cracks or whatever. So go and check that thing out. And it's good to be with you, Ross.
Yeah, for sure. If I had to instruct our fan base, our listeners, our Packers fans, the things that you need, number one, grab a tablet if you can, and just have that PDF of the Cheesehead TV draft guide right there for you. Phenomenal. Obviously Packers specific, you know, it's going to be guys that fit their scheme, people that cover the team, people that love the team. And it's something that's really important as far as, you know, you talk about my work over at Packer Report, the Packers big board, which I will update tomorrow, which is my big board, and then slanted positionally to where I feel like the Packers need guys. So literally it would be, if the Packers have the first pick, I am taking Joe Burrow. And then after that, I'm taking Chase Young. which is not dissimilar from other teams, but I move the next quarterback way down the line just because I don't think they need a quarterback, but if I can get my hands on Joe Burrow, I would. I move positions that I don't think they are super, you know, needy on down. Like, for example, Burrow or Young, great, but Chase on and all the rest of the edges, it's going to be hard to crack that Smith-Geary rotation. So it's all slanted towards the Packers' need. So I would have that under control. And then the two big boards that you need to keep your eye on is the consensus big board by Arif, our buddy, over at The Athletic. And then obviously Thor big board is just absolutely big time. It's something too that, not that you shouldn't have it out constantly, but he nailed it. Get that thing out on Saturday and you'll have an understanding of, you know, some of these fifth, sixth, seventh round flyers. And then you'll also have an understanding of, you know, if they get a guy, in their UDFA class, Thor has it at 313, you think, all right, well, he was borderline. Maybe he, you know, makes some noise in camp, or maybe it's a guy that was, you know, 212, and you go, wow, that's a, you know, that guy probably should have been a sixth round pick. This is a phenomenal UDFA pickup. And you see that all the time where, you know, for whatever reason, it seems like there's somebody even in that top 150, top 180 that you get done with the draft. You're like, how the hell did nobody take this guy? Well, you know, that's something you can have your finger on. So that would be the four things, you know, get your tabs. If you can, multi-screen it at home. If you're here, if you have a setup like the Green and Gold Studio, get the tabs rocking, get the windows rocking, get the Cheesehead TV draft guide, get Packer Report up, get the consensus mock board up, or consensus big board up, and get the Thor 500 up, because you will be about the most informed guy. And if that, you know what, maybe you're in a Zoom and maybe it just sounds like you know what you're talking about. That'd be phenomenal, because as Thor and I kind of lamented in the pre-production meeting, the draft parties are not going to happen this year. And that's a really sad thing for myself and for everybody around. I think the draft, as much as it is for me a working thing, is a time to be around buddies, and it's a time to sell hope. And that's what the NFL draft is all about. That was something, you know, that I certainly shared with Thor. I loved the Saturday Sunday format. You remember that format? Oh,
yeah.
Thor?
Oh yeah.
It was the greatest. You got three on Saturday and four on Sunday. You could just bang the whole weekend out. Where my parents' farm was, I had like this unfinished basement, but they basically let my sister and I set it up with all our toys and stuff, and it was just like our zone. It had this like 9-inch tube TV stacked on top of some shelves, and I would turn it to the draft and just disappear all weekend. I don't think anybody minded either, but that was my jam. And, you know, obviously it was trying to figure out who, by the time I knew what was going on, I was trying to figure out who could get Brett Favre and those guys back to the Super Bowl. The answer turned out to be nobody, but that was such a fun time. And then, you know, started obviously as Thor did, seriously doing stuff in college and immediately after college. So I want to go through, if you don't mind, Thor, this class as a whole and where you think some of the strengths are. And then I'll kind of pop in and explain to these folks where, if that's good for what Green Bay needs or not. Where do you find the true strengths for this class? Where did you find positions that you got deep into them? You're like, yep, that's a useful player. And where were you like, oh boy, what do we do here?
Yeah, I'd say running back at the top, you know, running back probably down to 9-10 or so is really deep. I think in the middle rounds, if you waited until there, you could get a starter. That's one. Wide receiver, everybody knows this could go down as one of the great receiver class of all time, and maybe even the best receiver class of all time. I think it's a really good cornerback class is the other one. Both in terms of at the top, I think it's a nice first round one, something for every flavor there. And I think there's a lot of nice sleeper cornerbacks. So if you pick right, if you did your scouting work right, I think you're gonna see a lot of mid round type corners that turn into long term starters for teams. So that's another class that I like. The tackle class, I think, is pretty solid too, especially at the top. It dries out there a bit, so you might want to get yours early. But we obviously have the big four right after them. There's a tier of three or four guys right after them that's really strong. And I even like a couple of the guys after that, like Matt Pert from UConn is a kid that I like a lot. You know, Isaiah Wilson from Georgia is a kid who has risen, stuff like that. So that's another position I like. As far as positions that aren't very good, it's a terrible interior offensive line class. It's basically Cesar Ruiz, and then it just sort of falls off the table. It's a terrible tight end class. I really like Harrison Bryant from FAU, you know, but there's a lot of divergent opinions on that class. Like if you looked at 20 different, you know, quote unquote draft expert boards, you're going to see a lot of different tight end ones. And if you looked at the top, you know, their top tens, you're going to get almost 20 different iterations of what their top tens are. So that, you know, that's another sort of a weaker one. And then, you know, last year's class was crazy, you know, in terms of like the front seven talent. This year, it's not quite as deep, you know, in terms of that. You know, we don't have as much talent in terms of that. This class is more stocked with the skill guys. You know, it's more cyclical. This class, you know, last year was more of sort of your infrastructure type draft. And, you know, when I'd be on podcasts with like the fantasy guys, they would sort of lament that. And I'd say, wait for next year. Well, we're here now. And you're going to see a lot of guys that fantasy folks are going to get super excited, get taken next week or this weekend now, because we're just, I'm almost pinching myself. We're 2 days away. It's hard to believe that we're that close. But yeah, that's what I'd say. Ross, do you have a different opinion on that? Just bouncing back to you.
No, I like the take. And honestly, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I'm going to tie it into Green Bay, and that's exactly what you saw Brian Gutekunst do. I mean, yeah, Darnell Savage was a first-round pick, their second first-round pick, but you look at their top 75 picks, other than that, it's not only beef, but it's beef that you don't love this class. What did they get at 12? An edge rusher. As many questions as Rashawn Gary has, he would for sure be my edge three. And I'd be talking myself between him and Chase on. I mean, whether you like Epineza or Okora or Weaver or whoever, I mean, just based on raw potential, I would have Gary, you know, above.
And by the way, I wasn't a big fan of Gary, but yes, I agree with you. I mean, Epineza, Chase on. I mean, right. You have to put Gary right around there just because of the athletic profile. I mean, because the edge four after that, I mean, I would put him above Gross Matos, you know, like I said, even with all the questions that I had about him. So, yeah, totally agree with that.
For sure. And honestly, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about as far as the depth in this class. And then the next thing they went and got was Elton Jenkins, and he would be, I think, with a bullet, interior offensive line one. Now, maybe not as a prospect. I think I'm giving him probably credit for his all-rookie performance and just being so good from day one. Obviously, I am one of many people that had him as center two behind Garrett Bradbury, but I like his game more than I like Ruiz or anything like that. And then you say, okay, how about the other top 75 pick? Well, that's Jace Sternberger, who I have Troutman TE1. I had Jace graded higher than I have Troutman graded. So Gutekunst, I think last year went after, and I maybe this is coincidental. It's probably coincidental, but it sure as hell worked out great that he went and secured these guys from positions that just don't have those dudes this year.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, just in terms of strategically, that was the right way to do it. And, you know, just talking about the Packers, I mean, like, you know, everyone says they need a, you know, probably going to be taking a receiver in the first round. I mean, you're sitting in a nice spot, you know. I mean, no matter the way that the board plays out in front of them, you will have multiple options there of guys that are going to be nice values there. You don't have to trade up or anything like that. Just, you know, enjoy your draft party. You know, they could sit, the Packer, you know, front off, they could sit back in their quarantines and, you know, everything like that, just kick their feet up, and multiple guys will drop down there for, you know, again, whatever their flavor is, you know, and they can just sort of choose between studs.
For sure. No, and I think you mentioned, so the top of the class, or the top of, you know, what works in this. Okay, well, you said wide receiver. That's obvious. I think they end up adding two. I think I really have kind of come all the way full circle listening to some things that Brian Gutekunst said yesterday, listening to some things that Aaron Rodgers has said this offseason. I actually do think that their first pick, whether Goody moves up, whether Goody moves down, is going to be one of these top seven or eight, maybe nine wide receivers. I think they're going to get somebody. If you take my top 10, which my 10th guy is T. Higgins, and you throw out KJ Hamler, because they're just not going to do it. I mean, they just don't take guys that short. But if you throw out those guys, you've got nine, and I think that they are going to leave the draft with one of those nine guys. Then you mentioned corner, and you think, okay, well, they spent a second on Josh Jackson. They spent a first on Kevin King, or the very, very top of the second on Kevin King after trading down. They have Jair, who they love. Here's the thing. Kevin King has an expiring deal, and Josh Jackson, they don't even know what they have. And the Tremont Williams situation is, they don't really know where they're at. Goody said yesterday that, basically, if the draft doesn't fall their way at corner and they can fit it under the cap, they'll just re-sign Tremont. He didn't say that specifically, but it's pretty much what he said. Corner is a spot they could use a guy. Wide receiver is a spot they could use a guy. And you get, you know, tackle is another spot where you said it's strong. Guess what? They need a tackle. I think Rick Wagner is an absolute Band-Aid. I think he is fine. I think there are teams in the league that will have worse right tackles than Rick Wagner, but that is the one thing. If I'm a little bit nervous about not taking a receiver at 30, is what you said just a few minutes ago about, if you're going to get your tackle, get him early.
Yeah. Cause there is a bit of a drop off there. Right. So, yeah, I mean, that could be something where, I I'm a big proponent of this in fantasy drafts. And if I did run, you know, a billion-dollar NFL franchise, I would do it the same way, which is I would bust it into tiers. You know, and people listening, you probably do this in your fantasy draft too, when you're looking at positions, you know, or whatever, like, I need this position, you know, these couple positions or whatever. And like, there's going to be a drop off after here. And I'm sure that the Packers do something like this where maybe they're leaning towards taking a receiver with that first pick, but they know as well as we do that this is one of the great receiver classes of at least the past couple decades. And, you know, maybe the best receiver class ever. We'll see, you know, what we'll end up seeing in a couple decades, you know, if that ends up being the case. But this tackle class, very strong at the top, but there will be a point where it just drops off the shelf, you know, and we could debate where that happens. But I think, you know, I would say around tackle 12 or so. I have Lucas Niang from TCU. I'd feel okay about him, but after that, at least on my board, I have Sadiq Charles from LSU. After that, he's got all sorts of character concerns. And then after that, you get down in like to the Trey Adamses, the Alex Taylors, the Hakeem Adeniji's. You know, you either have projects or you have guys that have like athletic limitations, like the Charlie Hex and, you know, different guys like that. And so, you know, in the middle rounds, the late rounds, as far as tackles go, you're going to have to take a flyer on a project. You're going to have to take a guy who has a glass ceiling on his potential. Whereas in the first round, if one of these guys falls, obviously one of the top four guys is not going to fall, but that tier that I was talking about, that three, or I suppose now we could say four, because it seems like Isaiah Wilson, maybe going in the first round here as well. So maybe we could say there's like the top four, and then you have sort of the secondary four, and that being Josh Jones, Ezra Cleveland, Austin Jackson, Isaiah Wilson. You know, one of those four guys is there. Maybe the Packers say, well, you know, they're here, and you know, when we come up again with our next pick, we're going to be able to get a starter at receiver there. Why not take a tackle here that we're going to feel really good about for a while? Because the next time we pick a tackle, who knows, maybe you know, all eight of the top tackles for sure will be gone, but maybe Pert will be gone. Maybe Winago from Auburn will be gone. Ben Bartsch will probably be gone. Niang will probably be gone. And at that point, like, I mean, like, you know, we're not going to want to take, you know, a Trey Adams and her, you know, a Taylor, whatever, like, and, you know, and sort of, you know, project him as someone that we need to rely on, you know, in the immediate future here. So I could definitely see that line of logic. So if you're a Packer fan sitting dead red on a receiver on Thursday and the Packers audible to a tackle, I would just say, be patient for Friday night, because I'm sure you're going to get your wish then. And I hate to say this as a Vikings fan, but the Packer front office typically knows what they're doing.
And then they nail second round receiver picks. They have for years. And I just saw, and I don't know, I mean, I don't think there's leaks in Gutekunst's camp, but betting odds, I just saw for the first round pick come out at minus 170 for receiver, which is really strong. I mean, I wouldn't call that a certainty, but that is really strong. And like I said, stuff Rogers has said, stuff Goody has said. But yeah, we have it tiered a little bit differently. I mean, I think my super duper studs, Wirfs, Willis, and Thomas, I think those are potential all pros. And then the next two are kind of my own little mini tier with Josh Jones and Mekhi, two guys that might be there at 30, but almost certainly will not be. Jackson and Wilson are just guys that I don't think tested well enough to be Packers. Bartsch and Cleveland did. And those are guys, as you mentioned, I have Bartsch at 69th overall and Ezra at 70. That's something we'll talk about, because I know it's something that you don't necessarily agree with. But those are two kind of sweet spot guys there at 62. And then my real sweet spot guy, Thorne, it's, I don't think it's something at 62, but certainly in round three, or you move up a little bit, and that's Jack Driscoll. Did you have a chance to watch Jack extensively, and what did you think about his game? Because what I saw was a right tackle with phenomenal feet, the ability to mirror, the ability to stay in front of rushers, who just is not physically ready to maul folks in the run game. But for a mid-round guy, if I've got the feet to at least stay in front of most pass rushers in this league, I have tremendous value.
Absolutely. Yeah. 6'4", 306, and a guy who was an awesome pass protector in the SEC for multiple years. You know, you're talking one of the top pass protectors in the SEC for multiple years. His issue, as Ross just said, it's in run blocking. And it's because of that frame and that lack of play strength. He's a guy whose body needs to develop. The question with him is, does he have that frame to add that bulk, to add that play strength? He's one of those guys where you can look at him either sort of glass half full or glass half empty. The glass half full is like, you know, he has that movement. We know that he's good in pass pro on the perimeter. So if he can just sort of add, you know, some more weight, and, you know, maybe we can get him to okay as sort of a run blocker, but, you know, he's never going to have, you know, great length, and there, you know, his play strength is never going to be, you know, if we could just get it to sort of, you know, close to average, that would be great. You know, and the other side of it is like, yeah, but he's only 6'4". He's always going to add length. So he's never going to have that power. Like, maybe you think about him as a guard, but the strength is never going to quite be there. So there is the sort of tweener thing there where you're sort of wondering like, eh, how could we do it? But he does have the tool set in terms of having the movement, in terms of having the pass pro. So you could get a sleeper there potentially. But you just have to know that caveat of like, in terms of play strength, in terms of run blocking, we're not there yet. So, but yeah, as far as a developmental guy, absolutely. You know, we talked about this before, the tackle class dries up pretty quick. And so you have to pick the developmental guy that you want. And it's kind of like, you know, when you talk about dating, and, you know, people say like, you know, everyone that you date is going to be kind of crazy. You just have to pick the kind of crazy that you can deal with. And it's sort of this way with developmental tackles, where like everyone's got warts, you know, in this class, like once you get past, you know, like the 100th pick or whatever. And it's just like, what can your staff deal with? What can your staff develop? And Driscoll's a guy that I could absolutely see several staffs being like, we can work with this, because you can't teach like the kind of movement and the kind of, you know, pass protection that we saw that kid do in the SEC. We can work around the, you know, the limitations as far as length and play strength. And we can sort of teach him, you know, the rest of this stuff.
Right. And he's a guy, you know, I think I'm not going to project him obviously to be a multiple time all pro, but a lot of the questions that you get with Jack Driscoll read like a David Bakhtiari scouting report coming out of Colorado. And again, I'm not projecting, you know, as I mentioned, multiple time all pro, whatever. But I do think that a lot of the same issues were questions that you definitely could have had. And Bakhtiari honestly wasn't that great of a run blocker for the first, I don't know, two and a half seasons of his career. That 100% got better as time went on, as he added functional strength. And that's why, that's one of the things, just from a philosophy standpoint, that I'm not crazy worried about with guys, because that is something that can be added. You generally can't add agility. You generally can't add speed. You can't add, you know, quick feet. You can't add a lot of stuff. But weight and strength can be tacked on by an NFL strength and development team, by an NFL strength and development staff. That can happen. You obviously can't be weak and play on the offensive line, but it is something that can certainly be developed and improved. And that's, you know, Driscoll's kind of my guy. And I think, you know, that is, from a Packers perspective, an interesting thought process as far as, let's say my guy, Josh Jones, is, and I think he like is the first round sweet spot guy. Let's say he is available at 30. Then I think you might get into a spot where they have a list of receivers, and it might not look like my list. It might not look like a lot of guys' list, but they have a list of receivers. And once the second to last one goes, they're on the phones and are trading up, because you've seen them do that in the second round. It's exactly, and they failed, but it's exactly what they did with Jason Spriggs the year that they wanted to take him to potentially replace Brian Bulaga. They had a list of tackles. Spriggs was the last one. They made their move. They went up and they got him. And as mentioned, it didn't work out, but I think you could see a similar thing where, let's say Ayuk and Rager, for whatever reason, Ayuk and Rager are available. And you know, Rager goes at 51. I would guess 52 is getting a call from Brian Gutekunst. You might see something a little bit like that. Thor, let's go through. And I want to thank my buddy Eli at Book of Eli NFL. Is a writer over at Packer Report. Does some awesome work for me there. But I sent him into my final big board. I'm not going to touch it again. I told everybody that I'm not screwing around with it. I was even complaining, I think, about Ross Blacklock, who is the guy we're talking about. Maybe I should move him down. No, just going to leave it alone. I put in the work, but we've got three guys that we've got six guys total, three guys that I'm a little high on and three guys that you're a little high on comparatively to the other one. And I'm going to alternate them. So first of all, I want you to defend your boy, Justin Herbert, because you have Justin as the 9th overall player. And I'm a Ducks fan. I'm an Oregon Ducks fan. I'm all green and yellow. If you put a, you know, obviously North Dakota State is where I live. It's what I do. Been involved with the program, been a fan since I was a kid. Everybody knows that. But if you had to put a gun in my head and say, okay, FBS program, it would be Oregon. And so I feel like I'm a Herbert truther. I'm a Herbert defender. And I see a lot of Herbert slander on the timeline. And this makes it look like I am perpetrating Herbert slander. Defend your boy.
As far as like ranking him in the top 10?
Right, because I've got him 24. You've got him 9. I mean, you have clearly different feelings on him than I do. If you're ranking a guy 9th, it means you think he's going to be a plus starter in the league, or at least a functional starter in the
Absolutely.
League.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just, you know, and going to my comp on him, going to another guy that's going to be near and dear to your heart as far as NDSU, because we had the same developmental staff with him, at Wyoming. I see Justin Herbert as just sort of the next evolution of Josh Allen. You know, you go back a couple years ago, the questions that Josh Allen had coming in, Herbert has some of the same questions. It's just he's a better version of that guy. You know, I mean, Herbert, 6'6", 236, tested in the 91st percentile. So you have a similar frame, similar athleticism. You're going to be able to do similar things in sort of the run game, stuff like that, stress defenses like that. You have the same bazooka arm. I mean, he can make every throw. He's got the kind of throws that drop your jaw and stuff like that. Like I said, similar weaknesses as far as, you know, accuracy and stuff like that, locking on to first read, feel, stuff like that. But they are less pronounced in Herbert than Allen. And that might even be a bit of an understatement. Herbert's a lot more polished as far as that stuff goes than he is. That does not mean that those concerns are not valid. I think that they absolutely are. And they're things that he's going to need to work on at the next level. You know, he does have that maddening propensity to lock onto guys. I don't love that he sometimes struggles in the face of pressure. But for me, it's not a deal breaker because it's not nearly as bad as, for instance, Jacob Eason, which is a quarterback who I really don't like, and Ross knows because we were chumming around at the combine a little bit, and I kept referring to him as Hackenberg 2.0, and that's exactly the comp I gave him in my Thor 500. But you know, Herbert's issues in those areas are not quite as bad. And plus, the other difference between those two guys specifically is that Herbert has the athleticism. You know, I think he'll learn. The other thing I'll say about Herbert is the two quarterbacks above him on this list, you know, on my list and most people's list, you know, in Burrow and Tua, they worked with all kinds of awesome skill talent in college, and brain trust, offensive brain trust. Justin Herbert really didn't work with either. You know, I think he might've worked with one or two receivers that are going to play in the NFL. They're both going to be role guys. And the offensive system that he played in did not behoove his talents very much. You know, it should have been more of a vertical and horizontal thing. And they were doing a lot of stuff in the intermediate area that, again, did not behoove the skill talent they had, nor his skill set. You know, you saw a lot of drop passes and stuff like that. And I think that his development wasn't done any favors by some of that stuff, nor did he have the talent to sort of elevate his game as far as that stuff goes. He had a solid offensive line, was the one thing that Herbert had going for him, but some of this other stuff as far as like running backs and receivers, he just didn't have the same kind of talent that the two guys above him on the board had to work with. I think if Justin Herbert had played in Alabama or an LSU, and sometimes I do this, by the way, Ross, I don't know what your process is with some of this stuff, but like, you know, I always think like, you know, in baseball or in basketball, I always think, you know, and I don't know because I never, you know, I'm not a baseball scout or I'm not like a basketball scout, but sometimes I think it would be like a lot easier to do that because the sport I feel like would be much easier to sort of isolate individual players. Whereas in football, I feel like it's much more difficult because it's almost impossible sometimes to untangle the individual from the team because, you know, football is such, it's so intrinsically a team sport that even like, you know, a position like quarterback where, you know, that's one of the more individualistic positions, it's still difficult to untangle that from, you know, both the play callers, you know, the situation, the context of that, but then also all the players around them, you know, the protection they're getting and the players that they're throwing to and how much is the running back taking pressure off them and stress off them and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so one thing that I like to do is a game that I call context swap, you know, and sort of think like, well, what if, you know, what if Oregon and Alabama had merely traded, you know, Tua and Herbert, or, you know, what if Herbert had been on LSU last year and Burrow had been on Oregon, or, you know, just doing different stuff like that and thinking about it like that. And, you know, I just think that Herbert, you know, you would have looked at him a lot more. I think his season would have been a lot better. His development over his career would have been better and stuff like that. And I think going to the next level, I think you're going to see a bit of a jump in terms of that. So I like him, but not to the degree of like, you know, all this stuff of like, oh, you know, Herbert might go above Tua. I'm not down with that noise. Tua to me is objectively the better prospect. So.
Sure. Yeah. My issue, I mean, that's me though. And I've been down on Locke, been down on Allen, been down on Kaiser, these guys with the big arms, that aren't accurate. I'm just down on, and that's the next guy, Jordan Love. Like, I'm not a Jordan Love guy. And I think a lot of the things you just said about Herbert probably apply to Love. And as I mentioned, it's just not a road I can go down. These guys, if there's one thing, in my opinion, and I think this is borne out over time, if there's one thing that almost never improves when you go from college to the pros, it's completion percentage accuracy. That your ability to mentally process can improve. I think even sometimes guys' arms get, stronger as they develop physically. But being accurate with the football, you very rarely see 58, 59% guys in college become 63, 64% guys in the pros. It just doesn't happen. What do you like about Jordan Love?
You sort of have to go back to 2018 a little bit, and then obviously, the profile and stuff. But, Jordan Love was a guy in 2018 who looked like, a top 10 or certainly top 15 type prospect. And, and then he's playing with a couple NFL guys, and Darwin Thompson, and he was playing with Ronquavion Tarver and Dax Raymond and stuff like that. And then those guys left, his coaching staff left, and all of a sudden he was playing with Paul Cruz, squad from the longest yard. And the coaching staff, the KVID, was kind of doofusy as well. And it was just the Jordan Love show. There was nobody else there. And it was like, I sort of think of it of like, Jordan Love was like sort of in his bedroom with his goth clothes on, and painting his fingernails black. He's like, where did my friends go? His dad had moved away. He's all pissed off. He's hating the world and stuff like this. And you'd see him on like certain plays. He's all just like frustrated. And he's like, it's like the teenage kid, like punching a hole in the closet, or whatever, like, all ticked off. And then it seemed like other times he was just like, screw it. Like, just kind of, I call it YOLO ball. He would just sort of like fling things up, I'm Jordan Love. I'm the most talented player on the field, and he would just, zing the ball, 60 yard downfield or whatever. Like, but you, last season, he went from like a, I don't have the numbers in front of me. It was like, he went from like a, it's like a 32-6 TD INT ratio 2018 to last year is like, I don't know what it was. It was like a, an 18-14 TD INT ratio or something like that. But you still saw, he was a guy who's ideal frame, crazy athleticism, and the arm talent's sick. He's one of those guys where the ball shoots out of his hand like a pitching machine, just whoosh. And he's a guy who's very comfortable in the pocket too. He's a guy who doesn't panic, looks like he was born back there. And so he still has all those different things. It's just, there was raw elements in his game, even in 2018. And then last year he got these bad habits ingrained into him. And so coming into this year, I'd knock him down a bit from where I would have thought about him in 2018, but just because of the flashes we have seen, and because of the context of last season and because of, the talent profile that is still there, and the position he plays, to me, it almost demands that, at least in terms of a flyer, that he be taken, as a sort of late first round pick. And I think that that's what's going to end up happening. Does that mean that I think he's going to turn into a plus NFL starter? I don't know. I'm not one of those draft guys that's like, watches these guys and is like, with every single person is like, this guy's going to be this for sure. I don't see it that way for every single guy. And there's very few guys that I look at as can't miss, just because I understand the reality of this, which is like, there's, every single season, even in the first round, there's several busts. And then, even in the UDFAs, there's going to be guys there that turn into starters. Every single drafted player has a risk profile, no matter how high they're taken. And even, again, even UDFA guys, they have a shot of carving out a niche. Some of them even, long-term niches. And so for me, the way that I look at it, it's more sort of like stock, buying stock. And Jordan Love's a guy, you talk about like the high ceiling, the boomer bust type thing. And just because of that position, it's the kind of thing where he finds the right staff, he finds the right situation. You're looking at that sort of boomer bust type stock. That's how I see him.
Sure. And the last guy is Ezra Cleveland. I've gone up and down with Packer Reports, Peter Bukowski, who's an Ezra guy. I just get, and I think a lot of Packers fans would, I get Jason Spriggs PTSD, man. You see him get beat inside. You see, you know, you wonder about the level of competition, certainly, in the Mountain West. How many top-level pass rushers is he really dealing with? Does not move Mountain West defensive ends in the run game at all. Not a finisher. Just doesn't seem super tough. And as we mentioned with Jack Driscoll, you know, just getting in front of guys and being a good pass protector is valuable. He's a phenomenal athlete, like a 95th plus percentile guy. That's all great. But then for me, it's like, okay, well, why would I have him 50, 60, 70 spots ahead of Jack Driscoll? Obviously length, having played left tackle instead of right, all those kind of things. But why am I low on Ezra? Cause you have him as a first round guy.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. And what you say, I can't disagree with you on any of that, you know, and not only does the tape bear that out, you know, specifically in the run game, he's not a mauler. You very rarely see the pancake served on tape. He has a hard time moving guys back. You know, you see a lot of stalemates in terms of that. He does bring the movement, though. You know, what he tested as, you do see that. He's a guy who needs to be taken by a zone team. You know, in the run game there, I think he's going to be fine, because I don't think he's going to have any issues hitting targets no matter where he needs to get to them, just because of those movement skills. But as far as, you know, moving guys back in a phone booth, not his game, and it's never going to be his game. And his PFF grades bear that out. I mean, last year, 78.2 as a run blocker, that's decent, but it's not great, you know, as far as like a, you know, when you're talking about like a, you know, NFL kind of a guy who's 81.
And you would want him to murder Mountain West edges.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, as far as in pass protection, that's the reason, you know, that, you know, you're talking 6'6", 311, very good in pass protection. The movement out there, you know, the shuffle and the half moon, staying in front of guys. He's just a real pest in pass protection. He's a guy that is very difficult to beat with movement. He's a technician there, got a lot of reps, you know, over the last several years. You know, he's been starting for a while out there. So, you know, in terms of that kind of stuff, and it's funny, you know, and Ross, this might just be a contextual thing, because you're getting the Spriggs PTSD. I don't know if you saw my comp on him.
Brian O'Neal. Yeah.
And it might, you know, again, it might just be, you know, the different things that we see when we see these different guys. But when Brian O'Neal came in, I didn't like Brian O'Neal coming in either. You know, when I watched Brian O'Neal's tape, it was like, man, this guy does not have it. And, you know, he can't move people and stuff like that. And then my Vikings took him in the second round. And I was like, you know, my buddies called me and, you know, I was telling them, like, I don't see it with this pick. Like, I think they're making a mistake. And it's just because it's a, you know, they're a zone team and they're, you know, all the tackles got taken early and they just sort of panicked and stuff like that. And Brian O'Neal made me look like a damn fool, you know? And so, like, you know, again, you know, if Ezra finds his own team, you know, and he's used correctly, I think he's a guy that could level up. But, you know, guys like this, it can go both ways, Ross. And I think you brought up a really good example of where it could go the other way. You know, you're looking at him kind of glass half empty. I'm looking at him kind of glass half full. He has the clearly delineated strength, you know, that not a lot of guys that have that length move that way. God only makes a certain amount of people that way. But what you said is also true, which is that he does not have that power and he never will. So you can look at him both ways. Either way, though, I think we both agree he's got to go to his own team.
For sure. And Green Bay is his own team. And you know, that's a guy, and I've mentioned it, obviously, Brian O'Neal. It's important, I think, in this business to admit it when you're wrong. And I was wrong, or I, unless something crazy. You know, I always say, don't tell me what a guy is until after 3 years. It doesn't really apply when guys are good, because they usually, you know, continue to improve. I think you can say Jair, for example, the Packers corners, you can say Jair's good because Jair's good. I'm not going to write off Josh Jackson until he plays three and a half seasons and gets, you know, snaps, because then, you know, you write a guy off too early, and thank goodness Miami did what they did. But, you know, you could miss on Devontae Parker. Look at him and look at how long it took for him to develop. I can't stress this enough. I think I did this last year, commandments, draft commandments. do not write guys off until they've played at least 3 years in the league. And that sometimes is even too early. And I would say specifically for young guys that if they end up, you know, basically not having a camp or having a really truncated camp, I would give guys even another year where they can get one more training camp under their belts too. This is going to be a weird year, in my opinion, for evaluation. Thor, how good are you doing on time?
I'm okay. Yeah, I could probably go.
Because I've got three.
Yeah, I could probably go another most half an hour or so. Then I probably got to get going. But yeah, we could go 20, 30 more. Yeah.
Sounds good. All right. So my guy, and we're not that far off on this guy, but I'm gonna make my case, and you can certainly rebut. Jordan Elliott is just a guy that I think has the wide frame where he can play a little bit of one in nickel, certainly can play three and five when you're in base, and I think has a lot of versatility. PFF loved this guy, and I mean absolutely loved this guy. Highest rated run defender in the SEC, I believe his junior year. Really good pass rush grade, doesn't necessarily bear itself out in sack numbers, but I saw a guy that was getting double teamed. I saw a guy that was really living upfield, living in the backfield, able to cause disruption, could play the run on, you know, on the way to the quarterback, which is an old Ben Fennell wording that I just love, play the run on the way to the QB, get upfield. And that's what I see in Jordan Elliott. I gave him a late first round grade. You're more in the mid second. Give me your Jordan Elliott take. And this is one where we're not that far off.
Yeah. And like you said, I mean, not just in terms of run, where he was the highest graded guy in the class, I believe last year in terms of PFF, I also believe he was the highest graded pass rusher, you know, in the interior, you know, higher than Kinlaw, higher than Brown, obviously Matabuki and Gallimore, stuff like that. And clearly the highest graded overall. Elliott was dominant last year, super duper disruptive. And like you said, he required help on almost every single play. You know, when you think about him, you know, in projecting to the next level, it just comes down to the movement thing. You know, there's athletic limitations there. And, you know, with this class, the couple guys that I have above him, and I'm sure that, like, when we think about, like, the top five guys in this class, that the slight differentiations that people would have on Elliott, it would probably just come down to, like, you know, where you see Matabuki and Gallimore and Davidson and Blacklock, like, in comparison to him and stuff like that. But for me, it's a bit easier to – I mean, Matabuki is my guy, you know, as far as some of those guys. And then I had Gallimore four. But like those guys, because of the movement and some of like the, you know, being able to project them and shooting the gaps and stuff like that in the NFL, because of that, Elliott's game, it seems like to me, I just have a little bit more trepidation as far as moving that to the next level, because, you know, there was more power elements that he was able to sort of knock heads against the SEC guys and sort of cave stuff in where he's creating some of that disruption, pushing the pocket. And like you said, it wasn't leading to as many sacks, but he was, you know, he was winning a lot of pass rushing reps, you know, where it shows up like in the PFF and stuff like that, where, you know, you consistently see him sort of shoving back the center and shoving back the guards and like getting back there and stuff like that. But like, you know, in the NFL, my one concern with that is just like, when his sort of trump card, like with stuff like that, when some of that stuff is sort of negated, is he going to be able to develop the pass rushing moves, like more of them, you know, become even more crafty, even more of a technician, you know, and stuff like that, you know, and continue to be disruptive and stuff like that. So it's just like questions like that, just because of the athletic limitations.
Yeah. And I understand that. I do. I just, like, for example, Kenny Clark is like a 70th percentile athlete. You know, he's a 7 on the RAS in Green Bay and in general. Now, of course, Iron Dolan's a freak. And most of the top, it's funny, most of the top guys, regardless of positions, are freak mm-hmm. athletes. It just happens to kind of go that way. I mean, you look at athletic testing for Kelce and Kittle. You look at athletic testing. I got in an argument with a guy on Twitter the other day. I mean, everyone except Jarvis Landry in the top 10 last year was an 8+ RAS guy at wide receiver.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tackles in general, the best athletes are the best tackles. it definitely applies to edge rushers. It applies to edge rushers in a huge way. There are very few average athletes getting 10, 12, 15 sacks a year. And I completely understand that. With interior defensive linemen, it seems like, you know, guys can make it work even if they're not 95-plus percentile athletes. We're going to kind of throw Ross Blacklock under the bus right now, and we're not going to have the same conversation. I know you wanted to chat about him. I just see a little bit of juice. There are obvious, I think, athletic restrictions with him. I understand where you could certainly be coming with on that, but I want to talk about two guys because they're guys that I've been trumpeting for a long time. The number one guy, and I felt like I was kind of going out on a limb, our buddy Mark Jarvis, who does phenomenal work, does very individualistic work, has no care for groupthink whatever.
Yeah, here.
But does a really great job in compiling that database where, you know, folks that don't have access to the College All-22 can go and find these guys to watch, watch cut-ups where the player's highlighted, where the commercials are taken out, where the junk in between the plays is taken out. Mark does a great job with that. And we just, like Thor said, here, we want to give Mark a shout-out. He has Ashton Davis as his number three player in this class. I thought I was jumping out on a little bit of a limb with Ashton at 21. You have him as a late second round guy. I'm going to tell you why I love him, and then you can kind of come back with why you feel he's more of a second round guy. I just feel like Ashton is the best single high safety prospect that I've seen since Malik Hooker. Track star at Cal, phenomenal range, ball skills are fine, but just the ability, I think, to play cover one center field is so rare in this league. The box safeties, as far as I'm concerned, grow on trees. You can find box safeties all over. I mean, you saw that for years with Nick Collins. The Packers would play just some bum at strong. Even with HaHa, for the longest time, they would play some bum at strong, whether it was back in the day, it was M.D. Jennings or Jerron McMillan, and more recently, you know, it's been Kentrell Bryce. Just anybody can play that box safety role. Is your team better if your box safety is Adrian Amos and he's a good player? You're damn right. But the free safety is the tough one to find. And if you play a lot of two shell, they're kind of interchangeable. They don't matter as much. But if you're going to play this eight guys up at the line, this Seahawks cover three, all of this cover one stuff where you've got, you know, kind of a center fielder, then if you want to be really successful, you've got to have that guy in the back end that can really get from sideline to sideline. And I think Ashton Davis is the best version of that player that we have had since, in my opinion, Malik Hooker.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't even necessarily disagree with optimism on Ashton Davis. I liked Ashton Davis a lot. You know, and like you said, the athleticism is insane. He's a four-time track All-American. I mean, he qualified for the NCAA championships a couple of years ago. And you see that when you watch his game. I mean, ridiculous speed, ridiculous movement. And what I like about him, too, is it's not just that, because you have some of these guys that are track stars, you know, and have that stuff, you know, on, you know, in track, but that it doesn't completely translate for various reasons. And Davis, he moves like that, but he also sort of runs and plays with an abandon, you know, like Donovan Peoples-Jones was just the guy that popped into my head when I was like, it doesn't really translate. You know, there's guys where it just doesn't really translate. But, you know, Davis's movement absolutely translates like in a one-to-one kind of ratio, you know, in this sort of way. The trepidations there, I have them five, which I feel like is fair. Like I have them one behind Delpit in my safety rankings. And I really like Jeremy Chinn, you know, is probably like that, you know, it's like, so that's sort of where I have them slotted. But like, you know, as far as Davis, you know, play strength is a little bit down. And then the other thing, as far as like the projection or thinking about him over, you know, the next 5-6 years or whatever, is he kind of has this weird background where he only played a couple years of varsity football because he had like this late growth spurt. So he's very sort of inexperienced. And then the other thing is he walked on at Cal He didn't play his first couple years. And so the experience is not a lot. And he's going to be 24 in October. And so he's sort of developmental in that there's sort of raw aspects to his game. You're going to have to teach him some stuff. But the strange part of it is usually when you're talking about those guys that haven't played a ton, and you're going to have to teach him some stuff and stuff like that. And as far as specifically with Davis is like, I think about him, there's like some wild child aspects to his game. Not like some other guys in this class. Like for instance, Kenny Robinson is like, he's the joke I made about him in my column. It's like, if people listening to the show have watched How I Met Your Mother and Barney Stinson with the Vicky Mendoza crazy hotline, like Kenny Robinson is like constantly hopping over the crazy hotline because he doesn't play with any discipline at all. And he's always like leaving his spot in the zone. And he's just like, trying to be a hitman in coverage. And he's like, trying to go for the interception over just knocking the ball down and, get singed or like whatever. But like, it's not necessarily that way with Davis, but like, you will see him, running with crazy abandon and stuff like this. And like sometimes trying to make up for his lack of play strength by just sort of using his speed as a weapon, which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, because sometimes he comes in a little bit hot and he'll whiff and stuff like that. And so there's some of these different aspects to refine, but he is a little bit older, and so you have to sort of think about that and bake that in a little bit, as far as his evaluation goes. And so there's, just some different stuff like that. I guess I nicked him a little bit, as far as that stuff goes. But the stuff that you say, like, I completely agree with a lot of that different stuff, like, as far as like the single high type guy, and a guy that's going to help you a ton in coverage and stuff like that. Like, I agree with a lot of that stuff. And as far as like the sort of starter kit and stuff like that, I think he's got a lot of that stuff. And I think if he had gone to the combine and been able to participate, he unfortunately wasn't, but if he'd been able to participate in the athletic testing, I think he would have blown the roof off Indy. So, I see him as a second round guy. Maybe I should be a little bit higher on him, but I think in the second round, I think he's going to make a team pretty happy. And I think that's where he's going to go. So.
Yeah, I was really sad that he couldn't work out in Indy because, like I mentioned, the track background, really, really impressive for sure. Okay, so the last guy that I want to talk about, and it's odd because I feel like I'm defending your guy, or at least your alma mater, the damn school you've got on your head there and your Twitter profile, but Tyler Johnson. And this is a guy I understand, I will admit freely, that I don't think a prospect or his representation, his management team, whoever, could have handled the pre-draft prospect worse. As well as the bowl game went, absolutely torched Auburn, tore him to shreds, multiple NFL guys in that secondary. Obviously, you've got Marlon, you've got pros in the front seven, and just murder Auburn. And then, you go from that to skipping the Shrine Bowl, not running an Indy, and then having Minnesota's Pro Day lost to COVID. Just a rough deal, but the tape is so good. I've got Tyler Johnson at 67, and you're at 116. Talk to me about Tyler Johnson.
Yeah, it's like you said, he had a nightmarish pre-draft process, and he did it to himself. To start with, he doesn't get the invite to the Senior Bowl, which was indicative of the NFL being lower on him than draft Twitter had been, which is something that we had heard about for a while, and gets the invite to the Shrine Game, pulls out of the Shrine Game during Shrine Week, which that's not a great look. And he says, oh, well, it's because I'm going to get ready for combine testing. And then the week leading up to the combine testing, he pulls out of that too. And he's like, well, it's because I'm going to get ready for pro day testing. And, Ross and I were there at the combine, and I was able to ask Tyler Johnson some questions about that. I said, Tyler, you concerned about the way that the message that this is going to send to the NFL, about that? And Tyler was like, no, the NFL understands. And I was like, I don't know about that. And Tyler was like, well, they know I'm just going to get ready for my pro day, and I'm going to be ready to go then and show them, about my tests and stuff like that. And then, of course, the pandemic hit us, and he wasn't able to do that. And what was already a terrible decision, I think was made even more so because, you know, the NFL was already predisposed to see him in a certain way, which is a guy that lacked the juice. And now they're just, I mean, I just think that that's, they're just going to assume that, you know, he wasn't going to run well, and the agility tests were not going to be very well. We're not going to be very good either. But yeah, I mean, sure. Okay. So you have that, you know, and then the other thing is there might be some minor character concerns there. Maybe, I mean, like, you know, we don't know, but there's, you know, minor stuff is there. There's been some rumors about that. So those would be sort of the nitpicks on his profile. But, you know, when I think about these guys, you know, I say this a lot, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it's like what Ross said, you know, he's talking about the bowl game, and you can extend that back a couple of years because Johnson cooked a lot of guys in college, a lot of guys, you know, his PFF grades, you go back the last couple of years, counting stats, however you want to look at it, the tape, you know, whatever. It's among the best in the class, you know, I mean, by any metric. You know, it, now what he was, it was a slot guy, right? You know, he's a whatever 6'1", you know, 205 or whatever, and he's going to have to be a slot at the next level as well. So you are confined to that, you know, and you're going to have to think about him that way. He's not going to be able to play on the outside because he lacks the movement skills. So, but, you know, now in the NFL, you know, you have to consider it this way too. Whereas in the past, you know, even 5 years ago, certainly going back 10 or more, you wouldn't have seen a guy like this as advantageously because, you know, slot receiver, we weren't spreading the field as much, but now slot is a starting position in the NFL. So we need at least 32 of them. You know, a guy like Hunter Renfrow, you know, guys like this, they, in recent years, obviously, you know, looking at their pre-draft process, these guys, we've looked into them more. They've become more interesting during the draft. And a guy like Tyler Johnson, who consistently dominated throughout college to the degree that he did out of that position, he deserves a real, real look. And I do think, you know, despite some athletic limitations, it's not like he's out there like with a, you know, like a walker, you know, or something like that. You know, it's not like he can't move at all, you know, or whatever. There's some athletic limitations, you know, in that he's not like a stud athlete, but, you know, he's okay, you know, or whatever. He doesn't create the most separation or whatever, but he does have tremendous ball skills. And if you're a slot guy, you're going to be around a lot of bodies, right? And we know that Johnson can make plays on the ball and can pull the ball down with guys draped off of him. I mean, saw that a ton in college, and in the NFL, it's going to be even more so, but I'm pretty confident that he can do that. Now, is he going to be able to do a ton after the catch? No, I don't believe so. And so, like, you know, when I'm sort of projecting him, that's, you know, where I came down on him and where I ended up having him graded. That's how I see him, as a guy that could, you know, turn into a starting slot in the NFL, perhaps not, you know, one of the top starting slots in the NFL, but a guy that can be reliable for you, you know, a guy that you can get the ball over the middle, he's gonna make the catch, and stuff like that, and a guy that maybe even has a little bit more, just slightly more ceiling than maybe people are giving him credit for, not because of the athletic stuff, but because when he went to Minnesota, he did not go in as a wide receiver. He played quarterback in high school here in the area in Minneapolis. You know, and he just sort of picked up the wide receiver position when he went to college. So, you know, I think, you know, in terms of becoming more of a technician and stuff like that, in terms of his route running, I think stuff like that can get a little bit better in the NFL. You know, and as far as playing in the slot, stuff like that could level up his game a little bit, you know, if he dedicates himself in terms of that. So I think that he could be, like I say, I think he could become potentially, I think his ceiling is an above average starting NFL slot. And I think a guy, you know, as far as like a mid round guy, and Tyler Johnson, you know, the way that he's talked about in some of these NFL circles, some of the things you hear, you know, and stuff like this, like, seems like he's going to be available in the late rounds. I just think, man, at that point, take the flyer, especially, you know, like the local team here, the Vikes, it seems like they're going to take a receiver early. Seems like they might be, you know, in the market, you know, who knows, you know, you take an outside receiver first, you know, and if Tyler Johnson's sitting out there sixth, seventh round, if he has plummeted that far because of some of these concerns, I would absolutely take the flyer. I mean, you might unearth a longtime starter there for very, very cheap.
Yeah. And I mean, I just see such a high floor guy. I see a guy that just gets it. And I've often talked about, you know, covering North Dakota State, and with, like, for example, Jabril Cox, who just transferred to LSU. He was a high school quarterback. Give me all the quarterbacks. All I want, if I can build it, if I could build a college team out of high school quarterbacks, I would. They see the game in a different way. I look at a Green Bay team that, man, was rolling Geronimo Allison out there at slot. And yeah, I would love to have a super athletic slot like an Ayuk or a Rager that you can hand the ball to and have him do all sorts of crazy, you know, Brandon Cook stuff or whatever. But even just to have a reliable route running slot that understands how to get open against zone, how to find the hole in the defense, how to, you know, he probably doesn't run that well. Go look at the 60-yard post he scored on against, Auburn. I mean, the guy gets, he's a good player. And I understand there's maybe not a tremendous amount of upside. I do get that. But I just think you're looking at a 10-year guy that maybe in his best year will have 60, 70 catches out of the slot, and in other years he'll give you, you know, 30, 40, 50 grabs, whatever. But it's certainly, in my opinion, an upgrade over a lot of guys that are getting snaps. And as you mentioned, Thor, it's a starting position. You know, there are 96 starters now in the NFL at the receiver position. And I think he's got a chance to, you know, be one of the best 50 or 60, 70 guys at some point in his career in the league. Making him an average-ish NFL starter in that has tremendous value. And I think it'd be difficult to argue with. Hey, buddy, thank you so much for coming on, man. We've had a great time. I'm going to throw you on the spotlight one last time. I want the picks for the two Vikings first round, and then I want the pick for Green Bay at 30.
Sure. Yeah. For the Vikes, I'll say Denzel Mims, and I'll say Jeff Gladney. We'll keep Gladney in purple. And for the Packers, despite what you know, the whole size thing, I'm gonna say Rager.
I've done it. I've inceptioned Jalen Rager to the Packers into your mind. If I can only send those thoughts to Brian Gutekunst, we would be in business. I agree. I said, you know, absolute gun to my head, I felt like Rager was going to be the pick at 30. I'll probably be wrong. I'll almost certainly be wrong. But just overall, I think he makes the most sense as far as, you know, the diversification of that group, the talent, the ability to get up and down the field. Man, would Aaron Rodgers be a revelation? You look at that quarterback play at TCU. Thor, buddy, one more time, I'd like to thank you for coming on. I'd like to thank all of you guys for listening. We're just about there. Go, Pack, go. Oh. Oh.